Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence, and by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 97 for Thursday, March 31st, 2011. Ped Pros, step right up and get your Ped Pro. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us here for Auto Line After Hours. And I got to thank my co-host for showing up, as he does every week. Peter DeLorenzo, the auto extremist, is back.
John, it's our second anniversary.
Is that right?
Really?
I think so.
Holy moly.
Chip and I were talking about it earlier, and I think if it's not this week, it was last week.
Oh, my gosh.
Or something. 2 years of
2 years.
Auto Line
After Hours. That's unreal. I had no idea.
Congratulations, guys. I would have brought a cupcake if I'd known. Yeah, yeah. You know?
And also joining us is Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press, the car critic there. Great having you here.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that we saw break this week, I guess is maybe the word to put it, but David E. Davis passed away. In fact, Peter, I found out about it, and you emailing me talking about how he had passed away.
Yes, William Jeans emailed me. There was rumors on the internet through Facebook. And then William Jeans emailed me. I waited till he confirmed it. And then I emailed you, put it on Twitter, but it had already spread. It's the end of an era.
It really is.
But it's also, and as I point out in my column, I believe it's the formal end of the traditional print car magazines.
And I agree with you, but for our viewers, explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, interesting, but Auto Extremist is going to be a print magazine back in 86.
That was your original plan, with no
advertising. Just a hardcore ultra enthusiast magazine, no advertising. And I was convinced the manufacturers wouldn't give us cars to drive, so we were going to borrow from owners and just do all kinds of stuff. And my ad career got in the way, and by the time it came time to do it for real, the internet was there. And the internet, obviously, you know, it's old news, but it changed everything. I mean, you know, we all used to like getting our car magazines. You look forward to them, you page through them, linger on the pictures. Once the internet came, it was like turning over the anthill. And instead of four or five car magazines that we all liked or, you know, had favorites, there were hundreds of car publications overnight on the internet. And I think it changed everything. And so the car monthlies had to scramble and boost up their, you know, their online presence. David E. even went to Winding Road at one point, you know, because, you know, it was all trying to catch up to this. How do they make this work? And I think in the course of that, I think as enthusiasts, yeah, we still like the magazines, but it's more like this instantaneous thing. And I think the magazines are they still going to exist? Yes. But I think they're going to morph into like every other month or like this Motor Trend Classic.
Once a quarter.
Yeah. And I pointed out one of my favorite magazines right now is Vintage Motorsport, which is a beautiful publication. But I think they're going to become more specialized, and then the whole monthly thing is just going to fade, I believe. And, you know, not to obscure the passing of David E. in that, but, you know, David E.'s heyday was in the 60s when Car and Driver, you know, the whole societal shift in the 60s was mirrored in the media. And David E., to me, the most significant thing he did was he made sure the automotive world was represented loudly in that societal shift where the media was, you know, we had Rolling Stone come online and everything was seemed to be just exploding, and Car and Driver was right there. The tone, the tempo, the writing, everything about it, that was the heyday of, you know, monthly car magazines. And as I pointed out in my column, not that there isn't great writing now in the magazines. There's occasional great issues, But nothing like then, when issue after issue was just like, wow, what are they going to do next? And it was an exciting time. And to me, that's David E.'s legacy.
It's funny, though. I mean, David E. reinvented himself so many times, yeah, and brilliantly every time. But in some ways, if you look at the arc of his career, it also points out the challenges that face, you know, magazines and websites. I mean, you know, a few years ago, he was, you know, one of the founders, I believe, of Winding Road and set that up and, you know, discovered, like a lot of publications do, how difficult it is to monetize the internet. And at the end, he was back writing brilliantly and beautifully for Car and Driver, which has itself, like all the established publications, become a major web voice as well as the monthly magazine. But it raises the question of, you know, is the established brand name something that carries on throughout all of the different, you know, platforms, or is there a way to you know, completely break away from that model? And I don't think we know yet.
Well, I think Peter's got it right. I think it is the end of an era, you know, because when I was growing up on the Buff books, I would read the race report of the Indy 500, which, as you guys know, runs at the end of May, in the August issue.
Of Road and Track.
Yeah. Or all the Grand Prix coverage that they did.
It was always three months behind
the race. But I didn't care because that was the only source. You know, ABC Wide World of Sports might do the Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah, every year they do.
A couple of weeks after, not live.
Yep. Mm.
And so if this was the only source that you had, and it was, what's the guy's name that ran the Formula One team? Rob Walker wrote all the articles, so you got this great inside view. But I was perfectly willing to sit down and spend half an afternoon reading this about this race that happened 3 months earlier. That doesn't work anymore. That you just can't expect to do that. And I think so many of the magazines now are under pressure to bang out stuff, bang it out, that you just can't have the same quality of writing when you're just knocking stuff out. And as you guys know, most editors these days also have to put stuff on the web. So they don't have this time to sort of kick back and think about how they're going to craft the story.
And don't forget that these are conglomerate-owned things now. And I've had this discussion with Chubba Chetta before. It's there's two things that the conglomerates want to see is cutting costs at all costs.
Always, every year.
And not only cut costs, but more. To the point where, you know, I remember Chubb and I were talking in an airport one day. He said, you know, it's to the point where I have to just literally get rid of bodies to meet a financial statement. So it's just, but the instantaneous thing, it's just different now. I mean, Nate Ryan from the USA Today, he's a good guy, one of my favorites. He's reporting from on Twitter, from his when he goes to races, to the point where you know what's going on instantaneously. If you don't have access to the webcast or whatever's going on, you know, you're on Twitter and they're doing that, and you know, it's just changed. So the magazine has to have more of a reason than they used to have. That's why I think they'll go specialized, and I think they'll go every other month and make a bigger deal. I don't know what to say about Auto Week. I still don't know what to say about Auto Week, the reinvention of Auto Week every other week. I don't know. I mean, what does that mean?
Right.
Well, and doesn't all of that, and particularly the availability of instantaneous information, doesn't all of that argue for the idea of what's the value that's added by the publication or the brand name or the person, whatever it is? And you've got to figure out that thing and stick to it. And if you look at, you know, among the websites that have been most successful, if you look at, you know, Jalopnik, for instance, one of the things that, you know, they did is, you know, you're going to get snarky, you're going to get, you know, sarcastic if you go there. And that's a niche that they own. And everybody, I think, has to figure out what is the value that I provide, because just being there with the information is no use anymore. That you're not giving people anything special because they already saw it live.
That's a great point. And, you know, I don't know if a transition to tablet magazines, you know, that you can read on an iPad or something like that is the answer or not. I do believe that, you know, the more interactive, the more on-the-fly updates that they can do, the better off they're going to be. But yeah, I'm afraid that these print magazines showing up in the mail once a month or sitting on a magazine rack, I just don't see it surviving.
They're going to have to go in a different direction. They're going to have to become much more specialized. Really, I think so.
Well, it was real sad to see David E. pass because, A, I didn't see it coming, and B, that guy is the best storyteller I ever ran across in my life. It's just amazing how he could take any kind of little incident and just craft a story in a way that was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, and he really, he became one of his own characters in many ways. And did it brilliantly. I mean, he became the lord of the manor, the sort of, you know, the guy who at the end of dinner takes it upon himself to do the toast back to the host to thank you for inviting it, for inviting us all. And we all understood that that was his position because of the, you know, sort of gravitas that he brought and because of the way he could dominate a table when he wanted to with his stories. And we all enjoyed listening to him.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we had one of the famous David E. episodes here on Out of Line After Hours.
Yeah, boy, that was something.
That was something, you know, where he
went off on Jean Jennings.
He really ripped into her. But I didn't even catch on that that's where he was going. I thought he was just telling a great story about Jean and all this other stuff, and then it turned nasty. And I probably handled it a little bit differently today, because I was kind of in shock about the whole thing. But
well, there wasn't anything that tipped his hand before he got to it.
No, it really. Was at the punchline, yeah. Where you went, oh, my God.
Yeah.
He just killed her off. And, yeah, she's still pretty ticked off at me about that. But it is what it is.
Yeah, it was real time.
Right. I had one of my favorite trips of all in my career was with David E., and I was a very small group of Americans who were invited over to Ferrari. And, in fact, I believe we had the last interview that Enzo Ferrari did with any journalists. I'm pretty sure we're the last ones. I never saw anything written that came after the interview that we did with him. But I got to spend like a whole week traveling around that part of Italy with David E., and it was a riot. I mean, it was just, you look forward to every minute of it. And he would just tell stories whether you were going to listen to him or not. I mean, it didn't stop him whether the audience was paying attention or not. And there were times when it's just like, okay, David, lay it off. Just leave it. You've told us enough. And then 3 minutes later, you're laughing your head off because the thing's so funny. So he was a unique guy.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but the first time I was on a vehicle introduction and I realized I'm sitting across the table from David E. Davis, I was struck dumb for probably half of the dinner. I couldn't believe that I was actually sitting with the man, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, probably good time to take a commercial break, our first commercial break, and then we'll bring in our other guest who's coming on today's show. But first, let's talk about the Chevrolet Cruze, which you can check out at Chevrolet.com/cruze. That's C-R-U-Z-E. In fact, I should tell about the Cruze that I'm test driving right now, the Eco version, which has actually impressed me for three reasons. You know, most high-mileage cars that you get from a car company, they're L-Stripo. There's no sound deadening in them at all. They're geared so high, it's just they're not fun to drive, even though they may get good fuel economy. But what I do like about this is it's surprisingly quiet. It's surprisingly comfortable. And the engine, this is a 6-speed manual. The engine, the 1.4 turbo, has got a pretty flexible torque band to it. That really surprised me, too. So I don't know what you thought of them, Mark.
I haven't driven the Eco yet. And, in fact, I was interested looking at the one you've got in the parking lot, because that little spoiler on the trunk lid gives it a very nice and recognizably different look, I think. It's an interesting looking package. And I think that I'm with you on the 1.4-liter turbo. That's a really nice engine, you know, mated with, you know, the with any transmission. I mean, it's very flexible. It's a good piece of work.
And this one, I don't know what if this is a running change or something, but at least on this Eco model, they've got this cloth on the dashboard.
Oh,
padded
I love
cloth.
That.
And it looks really good.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen it on other cruises. So.
It was one of the ones they showed, and they said they were going to take it to production, but I haven't seen it. It hasn't been on a vehicle that I've driven yet.
Yeah, well, check
it
out.
It's a really interesting creative use of materials.
Yeah. I thought they did a pretty good job on that. But anyway, let's bring in our guest here, Joel Piskowski, who's the head of all exterior design at Ford for the Americas. And he'll have a microphone on him in just a second here, and he'll be able to tell me if I got that right or not. So, Joel, did I get your title right?
Yes, John. Yes,
good.
Indeed. Thanks for having me on.
Well, great having you here. Absolutely.
That's a pretty big deal. Title, folks out there, in case you're wondering.
That's right.
No, I'm very honored to be part of this illustrious team of designers at Ford Motor Company.
Oh, I can imagine. So explain exactly what your job entails. I mean, I just said all exterior design Americas, but what does that mean?
Yeah, so I'm the design director for all the Americas for exterior design. And what that is, we've got the North American studio here in Dearborn, Michigan, and then the studio down in Brazil that kind of report through myself and then up into Maury Callum and ultimately into Jay Mays.
Uh-huh.
So I'll be taking my first trip to Brazil next month.
And is it, I mean, one of the things I don't understand as Ford becomes more of a global product, a company with global products, we've got the Focus that's sold in North America, but that's a design that was done in Europe. So how do you figure which vehicles you're responsible for? As the head of for the Americas,
it's not so much my responsibility to allocate which vehicles are designed where. It's coming from the top of the house under Jay Mays' guidance and direction. But sometimes there are international design sketch-offs. But generally from
and we heard about one of those recently where there was I got a million emails from people saying that, who had heard that Australia was going to be designing the next Mustang, and I had to send back, no, there's a contest. They're taking samples from a lot of people. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about? There's a class of vehicle coming up, and all the different studios will get to suggest ideas for it?
Oftentimes that happens. However, from North American standpoint, we really focus on CD cars and larger, including, of course, F-150s and trucks, which are...
Trucks and big cars is what you got, right?
That's what North America is about. And then from a European and global standpoint, there's a lot more focus on the C segments and below, as well as like the Transit Connects, the delivery vehicles, the more pragmatic vehicles that we don't see so much on our shores, but are very prevalent in Europe and throughout Asia.
So where does the break come in terms of passenger cars? C and below is Europe. Everything else is above that going to be North America? Or how's that break?
On a general guideline, yes. But at the same time, we cross-pollinate very often, as well as our design staff. We've got designers that are based from Dearborn, in Dunton, England, in London, also in Merkinish in the Cologne studio, a couple down in Brazil, and then we got a couple that are going over to China as well.
And Brazil's doing, Ford makes a vehicle called the Eco, right,
yes,
in Brazil. And
right.
So they'll be doing derivatives of that? Is that how it's going to work? Or will Brazil do?
As well as supporting new programs that are under development, John.
Mm-hmm. And when you say above C, that would mean in passenger car terms, Fusion and bigger, we could sort of think of as being things that are probably North America's responsibility?
Correct. Yeah. And,
And Escape and Flex and the crossovers and SUVs,
right,
as well.
Right, icons of,
yep,
F-150. And
sure.
Mustang.
Yeah.
Mustang. So, not a bad portfolio.
So, Joe, tell the listeners what some of the programs you've worked on, the highlights, like. You were at GM, right?
Yes.
And then, I mean, two stints in particular, GM and Hyundai.
What we should let the viewers know is,
yeah,
all that great stuff that Hyundai is selling like crazy right now, you're largely responsible for.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity to have that experience at Hyundai. And The two cars specifically, well, a number of cars, but the new Sonata, the new Elantra, the Genesis Coupe exterior designs were done under my guidance, but it was a great team of designers and very passionate out there in Irvine, California.
Yes, but you were there. What about GM? What did you do at GM that our viewers might?
I think the highlight for me was Chevy Colorado. Right. That was a globally developed vehicle, spent time in Japan working on that, Italy, and then back here in North America. It was a real fun project, worked on it holistically, interior and exterior. So, you know, they're still running around today, and finally they've announced a new one.
So, Lincoln, are you going to be working on that too?
No, I've got a new partner in crime on that. That's Max Wolf.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Max has
some of the recent Cadillacs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Came from GM. Mm-hmm. Ford's lining up some heavy hitters here, aren't they?
Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, that I find interesting is how the different companies separate the responsibilities and the expertise. Ford has got, you know, the design group in Brazil. Are they just working on stuff for that market, or do they contribute ideas for things, you know, in other markets as well?
The Brazilian team is pretty much focused on the Brazilian market and the exclusivity of that. And, of course, those vehicles that are being developed for Brazil, you can kind of translate that into the BRIC countries. So it will have a global pollination, but at the same time, a little more of a local mindset to it.
So where's design going, in your view, for exterior Ford in the Americas? For example, oil prices are going up. Is aero going to play a more major role than it might have otherwise?
You know, I think, quite frankly, aero has always played an important role, even more so now, to your point, John. And we are taking very conscious efforts to hit our aero targets, to hit the fuel economy targets. Of course, you know, CAFE standards are increasing almost by the month. And so it just provides that many more challenges for the design and engineering teams to meet those targets.
But I guess what I'm getting at is there doesn't seem to be a whole lot new from an aerodynamic standpoint in terms of what engineers or even designers know to make a car go through the air more easily. But now they're putting that stuff on cars,
right,
and especially on the under tray of a vehicle. I'm starting to see a lot more belly pans or partial belly pans, especially in closing off the bottom of the engine compartment, sealing off the engine compartment. Both Ford and GM now have got the louvers that move to seal off the front end. And I guess that's what I'm getting at is, yeah, aero's always been important, but it seems to me now that automakers are going, yeah, we better spend a little bit more money and put these things on.
Absolutely. It's a very conscious effort, you know, from the ground up, as you mentioned, John, how the underbody is completely developed with aero in mind from the onset. It's the undersides are very, very clean, even if there aren't any closeout panels. So it's a very conscious effort to develop vehicles that are efficient because of all the concerns that we have moving forward with our economy and fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that in the past sometimes aero has gotten, you know, a bad rap because people, you hear it and they think everything is going to look like a jelly bean. You know, how constrained are you in terms of specific brand characteristics and model characteristics, and how do you protect the individuality of a brand so that it's more than just a badge?
Well, the interesting point, you mentioned the jelly bean comment, and I think that's a perception that many people harbor as far as being aerodynamic. It's got to look very slippery. Actually, quite conversely, sometimes the more bricky the vehicle is, especially at the end of the vehicle, really has a much lower coefficient of drag. So the softer the vehicle in the rear, the more problems you're going to have. So actively, from a design standpoint, we're always trying to widen the corners of the vehicle at the rear, put little splitters or trippers at the corners of the vehicle to break the airflow. So it's a real conscious effort, and it's a very iterative process. Doing aerodynamic testing is a black science. We've got all these wonderful computational fluid dynamics that we can test with, the wind tunnels and such, but at the end of the day, it's really just getting in there. You can tweak a surface by 2 millimeters, and you can drop 10 counts of arrow just like that.
Wow.
So it's such a very, very sensitive topic. And, you know, even the exterior mirrors are a very integral part of that whole aerodynamic makeup and efficiency. So, you know, we're honing mirror surfaces to squeak out a few more tenths of drag coefficient to really make the vehicles perform from an efficiency standpoint.
So, Joe, this is After Hours. Let's talk about some other stuff. As a designer, I know a bunch of designers, hang out with designers. You guys are all, you soak up everything that's out there. You love looking at everything. Off the record, you sit around and say, I like that, I don't like that. So, what cars come to mind that you like, knowing full well what you're doing? It's just kind of a professional courtesy as a designer. What cars, first of all, what do you think of that Volkswagen, that advanced high mileage thing that Volkswagen just showed? I think they unveiled it in Dubai.
Right.
It was like the fourth generation of their 1 liter concept, which I thought the latest version was really good. What'd you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's a very provocative vehicle that they're bringing into the marketplace, and I'm not quite sure what their target is for that.
Yeah, but nobody knows. It's a Ferdinand PX. You know, it's like it's the boss wants to do it, we're doing it type of thing.
So, and that's fine. I think it's a great effort on their behalf. Stylistically, very clean, pure. It sends that aero message to your point, Mark. And if you really look at that, that whole vehicle is set up for aero, and the rear of that vehicle is completely chamfered off, so the air breaks around the corners. And very, very interesting and compelling vehicle.
So let's see. What else do you like? Do you like the new 458 Italia?
For the most part, I do. Ferrari has some strong hits and some stronger misses.
Boy, I can't abide the FF at all. I can't do it.
There's a few acronyms you could play off that word.
Yeah. I mean, do you like the Audi R8 better than the 458? For different reasons?
I think if I had to spend my own money, I'd probably do the R8 myself.
Yeah.
It's just a.
So, have you seen any Mustang sketches you like?
I've seen a lot of Mustang sketches I like.
That's good to know, because everyone's hand wringing about it. Yeah. I know that.
Yeah, well, the Camaro's gone ahead in sales right now, so Ford's got to respond somehow.
You know, it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. So it's every month, every year, it's something different. And all I can say is Mustang is an exciting product. And I think what you're reading now on the Boss 302, it's a phenomenal performance vehicle from a driver standpoint, performance, getting some really fantastic write-ups. I don't know if you've had the chance to drive one yet, but really fun. No.
The vehicles like the Mustang have a particular set of challenges too, don't they? Because everyone knows what they think a Mustang should look like. I mean, isn't it the vehicles that are really kind of the symbol of a brand that give you the most sleepless nights?
Yeah, and I think, quite frankly, the reason behind that is that everyone has so much passion behind those vehicles, and everyone has their own picture in their mind of what a Mustang is. You know, for some people, it might be a 65. Others, it might be a 69. God forbid if it's an 82. But nonetheless...
Mustang. that was the depths.
But people forget that the Mustang 1 concept bore no resemblance to anything.
No, not at all.
It was cool.
You're talking about the mid-engine one.
Yeah, that they unveil at Watkins Glen.
But remember, when we had Hal Spurlick here, he said the production Mustang was already done when they had that Mustang 1 concept.
That's right.
Just sort of like, I can't remember exactly how he said it, if they just threw the Mustang name on it because they had done this cool little car, or they were just trying to get everybody jazzed about the Mustang
name.
But he said that the production version, they had already settled on it by the time that Mustang 1 came out. But that Mustang 1, still today, I think, is a cool-looking car.
Very cool. Very cool.
Indeed. So it's all about the icons, and definitely Mustang is an icon for the Ford brand, along with F-150 here in North America. So it's...
Okay, so you're head of Ford North America, or of the Americas design. What about doing things like the Taurus, even the F-150, Explorer, and the like, that could be exported more than they are today? Because Taurus isn't exported much at all. Mustang isn't really exported much of all at all. It seems to me Ford's got a real opportunity here all around the world to, you know, take advantage of all these little niches that right. could produce a lot of volume in the total.
Well, you know, certainly Alan Mulally has this one Ford mentality that's been cascaded through the organization. And I think the organization from Alan on down are looking at opportunities to reach out into different markets. So, you know, whether that means selling a Taurus in a different country or bringing a B vehicle here, there's a lot of opportunity because the company is, again, focused on one Ford to unify the brand, whereas a few years prior, it was pretty much set up in silos.
Well, every region of the world within Ford did its own thing.
Right.
But you can't export, or I should say, one of the reasons that Mustangs and Tauruses and the like, even F-150s, aren't exported that much is from the get-go on the design, they were only designed for North America. So, you know, if you want to do a right-hand steer vehicle, major rip-up, major
Absolutely.
Cost.
Absolutely.
Even just from a homologation standpoint on some of the other simpler things, if you bake it in from the get-go in design, as you know, it's not that hard to homologate a product for export, whereas if you're trying to do add-ons or modifications, it gets to be prohibitive.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. It's you really got to start from the clean sheet of paper, you know, whether it's a clean underbody or knowing that you're going to be sending this vehicle into international markets that have width requirements of 1,900 millimeters to fit into certain parking garages. It's all part of the architecting of the vehicle.
So are you thinking more of that now with North American vehicles?
Oftentimes that's part of the process, absolutely, as it is with every OEM, quite frankly.
Is it new? I mean, for years, F-150 appeared to be sort of a kingdom unto itself, you know, engineering, design, everything. Is it new to have the design responsibility, final design responsibility for the F-150 residing in the same person who, you know, does, you know, who has responsibility for the Mustang, the Taurus, you know, the Fusion, all of that, or has that been the
process? I think it's been a pretty common process throughout the past, and, you know, even so in other organizations. Mm-hmm. It has to come to a point somewhere.
Joel, when you were at Hyundai, you put a lot of expressive design into their cars, the Sonata and the Elantra, particular. In fact, I understand it's very controversial in Korea. Some are saying that it's maybe too expressive, although it seems to be selling just fine.
On the Sonata or the Elantra?
On the Sonata in particular. That's where this too expressive criticism came out from Korea.
Yeah, that's what I've understood. But quite frankly, you know, our goal on that vehicle was to develop a vehicle that would be appealing to North Americans, and that's quite frankly what the California studio was set up to do, is to really get a pulse of North America and help to support the North American growth in the marketplace.
But this concept of more expressive design, is that something that you think that you'd be doing with Ford?
I think design goes in waves, quite frankly, John. And, you know, there's a certain point where you can just get too expressive and it just looks completely goofy and not appropriate. And you really also have to design for the brand. And by that, I mean, you know, Hyundai was a pretty small player in the marketplace. So you really have to make a strong impression. And to do that, we created some pretty expressive designs. Now, for a brand like Ford Motor Company, we've got a whole different set of customers and an audience and the whole history. Whereas at Hyundai, we're kind of inventing the history books, whereas there's a wonderful wealth of history here at Ford. So it's a whole different way to design, and also designing for longevity in resale is also quite critical. So we don't want to be too crazy or goofy with our design statements. It's got to be very, very mature, very appropriate for each market segment, and have just this nice and enduring quality to carry the brand forward.
The Focus and the Fiesta are both very different in their appearance from the Fusion and the Taurus. but the Vertrek concept that was shown earlier this year, which we all expect to be what the production Escape is going to look like, is, you know, very consistent with Focus, you know, and Fiesta. Are you looking to build, and forgive me, but I look at those and I think expressive because I'm not a designer and I probably don't understand really what the term means. Are you looking to translate that, you know, sort of flowing kinetic design, I know is the name they use for it in Europe, into the other passenger cars when it's time for them to be redone?
Yeah, it's the term kinetic design is what's been coined for those vehicles and the vehicles subsequent to that that'll be coming in the next couple of years. And that's a design language that has kind of stuck within Ford, and it's being developed, and it's not going to be a fixed design language, but it'll be evolutionary in a sense of you don't want to keep repeating it, because it'll become stale and everyone gets bored of it. And it's also about the appropriateness, too, of the vehicles. You know, on a B or C segment vehicle, I think you can be a little more expressive. And then as you get into this CD segment and even D segments, like a Taurus, for example, you really have to kind of dial some of that back and, again, really create a more appropriate design, but still using the DNA of kinetic, if you will.
Okay. In Europe, everything's got a similarity to it. And I don't mean they all look alike, but you can see the Ford family resemblance. But when you start mixing that with what you see in North America, I'm not sure that a clash is the right word to use, but they're definitely different. And while I see a given similarity between the Taurus and the Explorer, especially in the grille, I don't see any other similarities within the Ford North America product line. Are you trying to get to, or do you even want to get to, a family similarity, pass car and truck, with Ford North America, and then how does that dovetail with the design coming out of Europe?
Right. Well, I'm not going to give away the whole farm here, but yeah, again, going back to the appropriateness of design, if you look at the icons, F-150 and Mustang, you know, certainly there's a lineage and a history there that you really don't want to mess up that formula too much. So from that standpoint, you know, the icons and really more North American-specific vehicles have the opportunity, if you will, to still kind of reside as their own identity. And then again, as I mentioned previously, of you take the DNA of kinetic, and you know how much of that do you draw through the family lineage, and you can bring a lot of that through, even though it might even be an iconic vehicle in the portfolio. You can still get certain hints or whiffs of that DNA character. So more of the gene pool for a large family. You've got the cousins, the aunts, the uncles, the grandparents, the relatives. You know, there's always some familiar quality about their eyes, their mouth. They're not just you know, twins per se. So also too is you have to consider the volume of the vehicle. And in Europe, much smaller market share by volume versus North America. So in North America, we've got, you know, trucks, you know, 700,000-800,000 vehicles a year when you have F-150s and Super Duties and all the variants. So that's a whole brand unto itself. And then you've got the D cars, Mustangs, Edge, Explorer, you know, these kinds of vehicles also have their own identity. But again, I think we can bring some of the kinetic DNA and filter it into next generation vehicles.
And the Fusion seems to be, to me looking at it anyway, the Fusion size vehicle seems to be the point where there's the most convergence between, you know, the two markets,
right.
Because the Mondeo in Europe was the vehicle that Kinetic Design, I think, debuted on, and it's still, even 4 or 5 years later, it's still a drop-dead gorgeous vehicle, and that is very close in size to the Fusion that's sold here. Is that a vehicle that your group is probably going to have the worldwide responsibility for the exterior design of, you know, of the next one, you know, something that'll be sold as maybe a Mondeo, maybe something else in Europe, maybe a Fusion, something else, but the same basic look just as we see with the Focus in Europe and America today?
Yeah, certainly, you know, again, going back to the one Ford mentality, you know, I think there will be a lot of shared components. But for example, like with Fiesta and with Focus, you've got the opportunity to provide some local differentiation through some of the detailing, the grill work, the fascia work. You know, certainly we have different requirements in North America for bumper offsets. So we do have to homologate differently, and that provides us the ability to restyle bumper fascias a bit differently to appeal to the specific market. So, for example, to send a vehicle to China, you know, China has a different take or a different taste, if you will, on what they like and what they're looking for in a vehicle. So we have the ability to tweak and adjust and tune various elements of the vehicle, but at the same time, it's still one Ford, one vehicle on a global basis.
Well, the whole one Ford, you know, one platform kind of a thing is really to drive cost savings throughout the company. And, you know, if you're going to build a car in a country and have to tool it all up there, as long as you're cutting tools, you can make differences. You're not saving a whole lot of money there. I mean, my understanding is as long as you've got the hard points the same and as long as you're able to share a componentry, that's where the vast majority of savings comes from. And so doing the same fascia maybe isn't really going to save you any money at all.
Right. And like I said, you do have to cut different tools for different plants around the world. You know, the major parts really comes into the engineering cost of the vehicle. So you don't want to change the big components. But when it gets into the plastic bits, that's where you have a lot more opportunity.
Yeah. Hey, let's take another commercial break here. And it's time to get into rapid fire with our questions from the audience. But first, commercial break, because we really want to thank our friends at Bridgestone Tire. Check it all out at BridgestoneTire.com. They're on their third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Real interesting way of not ever having to worry about getting a flat tire again. You can get out of wherever you are and keep on driving, and you can learn more about it at BridgestoneTire.com. And Ben, let's bring in the rapid fire guys. So we're going to get into everything here. And I just start reading these things. I don't even know where we're going on this, Joel. But Stephen wants to know, what is Lincoln brand going to be besides a big chrome grill and optioned up Ford with $5,000 markup and MK fill in the blank name?
It's going to be more than that. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, I think Peter might be able to answer this better. Because he can say what he wants.
Well, I know that Ford has put in place a dedicated team to the Lincoln brand from marketing and the chief engineers to down to design. And it's a very dedicated team that's exclusively focused on making Lincoln the premier mark that it used to be.
Okay. That's PC enough, I guess. Jason wants to know, any retro design style cars coming from Ford? He says, it seems like Ford missed out on the PTHHR retro sales.
Thank God.
Yet Mustang's retro and sells incredibly well. Expressive design.
That's interesting that he thinks that Mustang is retro because it's really more of the iconic quality of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I don't see it as retro at all.
And to be honest, Jason, I don't think Ford's going to be doing anything retro anytime soon. So we're just going to keep evolving and make things appropriate and progressive.
I would agree. The Mustang is a modern interpretation of what the Mustang's always been. But a lot of people still do perceive that as retro.
Well,
not designers. I'm talking regular, everyday folks.
Sure, but I think a lot of it comes down to the design cues that are absolutely iconic. So, for example, the C-scoop on the body side, the porthole windows, the three-element tail lamps, a trapezoidal front grille,
long
big round fog lights.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay, Mike DeWight wants to know, are safety regulations making it harder for you to design cars?
Safety regulations are very challenging, especially from an interior packaging standpoint, challenging not only from a design standpoint, but from an engineering development standpoint, because all the safety requirements are adding mass and weight to the vehicle. So that becomes a challenge to keep the weight under control, keep the costs under control, and, oh, by the way, package it so it's not so intrusive on the interior, and so that we also get good sections on the exterior. We can contain the front overhangs because there's a crush zone required for safety. Now that there's a whole pedestrian protection, which we call PED Pro internally, that really has a...
PED Pro.
And that makes it hard for you to do a low sweeping hood line, for instance, doesn't it? I mean, you know, that seems to be one of the areas where we're running into a lot of cars having the you know, same sort of boxy, right, you know, front. How much of a challenge is that?
Well, there's a wonderful technology called pyrotechnics, and that actually it's like an airbag, but for the hood surface, so it actually discharges the hood up upon impact. So it's just an airbag for the hood almost.
One thing I hate about the safety regulations is how big the A-pillars are getting, to the point where I believe they're now a safety hazard because they block your vision going off at a 45-degree angle. I think it's a big issue.
I've talked to a couple of engineers, though, and they say that is sort of a learning curve, like a lot of other things. And if you take a look at the new Dodge Charger and 300, the A-pillars on those are actually, I think, slightly smaller than the last generation.
Oh, okay.
So it does look like something. There's probably going to be additional cost, but there do seem to be ways to avoid having those things that, you know, block half of your view, because some of them, they're diabolical.
Different materials, different lightweight, high tensile strength materials really help to shrink down those sections.
VRM Chris wants to know, and this is a question we get a lot, will the Falcon platform be twinned with the Mustang once again?
Falcon platform, what's that?
And by once again, we're talking about at the genesis of the original Mustang and Falcon back in, you know, 64, 65. I think, you know, they were together then, and they've sort of gone their separate ways ever since, with the Falcon turning into a big, powerful car in Australia that's unique.
But VRM Chris, anytime you start seeing designers get cagey and start dodging the question, you know you're on to something. Mike wants to know, is Ford still planning to do design changes every 3 years? I thought you were doing every 4 anyway. What's your design cycle?
Cycle plans are different from vehicle to vehicle. You know, there's mid-cycle actions where we do facelifts. Sometimes it's just the plastic fascia. Sometimes it's putting a whole new front clip on a vehicle. So it all depends on the vehicle and where we are in the market.
What would you say the average, though, is? You introduce a vehicle, and then 4 years later do a refresh, and 4 years after that do a clean sweep?
Three to four.
Okay. Not going to drag it out to 5? You hope not, right? You want new stuff all the time.
Customers want the new stuff, and you know we got to keep the products fresh.
Well, the designers want to do what the customers want, but the bean counters don't. They just want it as cheap as possible.
Well, when they understand the revenue that's involved, I think they get on board as well.
Glenn E. wants to know, four-wheel drive ever coming to the Mustang?
Four-wheel drive?
Yeah.
Never heard about it.
Oh, okay. George from Brooklyn, why is there no three-door Fiesta or Focus hatch? There is a Focus hatch, right?
I think he means a three-door, though.
Three-door hatch.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not quite sure. It's probably market-driven that either couldn't make a business case or there's not enough demand in the marketplace for it. Certainly, we see three doors as being a very niche segment, and if there's not a strong, robust business case, it's hard to justify doing that.
And you kind of took a chance doing, you know, the hatchback versions of both cars anyway, because conventional wisdom says that Americans don't buy hatchbacks, but that turned out not to be the case with the Fiesta. And are you seeing any indication with Focus yet?
Well, it's actually the Fiesta hatch is outselling the sedan version.
Which is amazing.
Yeah,
like at least 60%. Who would have seen that,
yeah,
right?
Such a good package, though.
We haven't seen what's going on with Focus yet, so it's still, I think, just getting into the marketplace
sure.
now.
Tim wants to know, what's coming up for the next generation Fusion?
Next gen Fusion.
Excitement.
What I can say is that there's a lot of exciting product in the studios, and it's a good time to be at Ford.
One Ford, right? Shouldn't the Mondeo just come over here and be the new Fusion?
Or vice versa?
Oh, really?
And C and bigger than C is his responsibility, more or less. So that would mean the Fusion, theoretically, you know, certainly could be something that is done in your, you know, studios for the whole world.
Right. Or globally.
Well, that's not speculate, is it?
Is it what?
Are you doing the next fusion?
I would be remiss to say that we don't have a hand in it.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Miradart wants to know, any plans from Ford to bring back an ultra performance car like the Ford GT?
You know, I think there's so much passion behind that vehicle that if it's not being studied, I know there was some comments from Derek Kuzak who talked about it, but not in any uncertain terms. I can unequivocally say that there is no development going on a GT product right now.
Okay, and this sort of ties into it. Danny Boy says, looking into Ford's crystal ball, is there a Miata-style lightweight sports car and or a Corvette fighter in Ford's future lineup? Please say yes to one or both.
Yes! Yes! No, there really isn't.
Okay, Ben, I see we got a number of phone calls coming in. Let's bring one of them in.
Hey, John, this is Rick from San Diego. I was wondering if Joel would know if Ford's planning on anything like the Subaru Outback from the Fusion platform. I think sells a lot, so just wanted your thoughts. Thanks.
Good point. Outback kind of has that segment all to itself.
It's a very distinctive vehicle, four all-wheel drive vehicle. It's kind of a tweener between a wagon and a CUV, so they've got a pretty good hold on it.
Well, it really is a wagon that they've sort of
convinced people is a crossover.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But wagons don't seem to do well in the American market.
No, that's a niche product here in North America, but on a global basis, they're very, very popular.
Okay, so we don't know if Ford's doing one, though.
No, we don't.
But you'd have to do one that size for the next generation in Europe, because wagons are such a big part of the market for that kind of car there.
I think the question about the Subaru is more this all-wheel drive,
right, I'm sorry,
higher ground clearance.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Ben, let's bring in another phone call.
Hi, John. This is Roger from Nassau, Bahamas. Is it possible for you to do a show in reference or invite someone from Mercedes-Benz on your Autoline after hours? Think about that, please. I haven't really seen a show like that. Thanks. Bye.
Great suggestion. We'd love to get some folks from Mercedes. So, Mercedes, if you're listening right now, we would love to get some people on the show, any of our shows for that matter. Ben, let's bring in another phone call.
Hey, guys. It's Nathan Keeley from Zanesville, Ohio, and I had a question about the upcoming Buick Regal GS. Autoblogs reported that instead of all-wheel drive, the Regal GS is going to come with front-wheel drive. So how is GM going to differentiate the GS from the standard turbo model? And whose decision was this, Wayne? Was it Ackerson's decision, or did Mark Royce make this decision?
I don't know.
How they differentiate it from the turbo, that's a hell of a challenge. I think that has to be, that should be the question that's keeping people at Buick awake nights. I haven't heard anybody give a really convincing answer for why they decided to go away from the all-wheel drive. We all figure that it was just a question of cost, and I think most of us think that it was probably a bad decision. I couldn't guess, how high up the organization, it went. I got no idea.
I would say Buick's probably not at a point where it can really sell all-wheel drive. I could see it getting there at some point, but I don't think that they or their customers are ready yet.
Well, they're talking about bringing over the Opel version of the Volt and putting a Buick grill on it. I think GM needs to step back a little bit on Buick. I think they're just going, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this, do that. And I think, hey, time out here, China's one thing, U.S. is another. Buick's just starting to get out of the gate. They need to ease up a little bit.
Yeah.
See some of these cars in the public's, mind before they start having an 8-car portfolio for Buick.
007 Mitch W. says, Joel, what do you really think about the safety regulation forcing a wide gap between an engine and a car's hood? And I think what he's referring to is that, what'd you call it, PED pod?
PED Pro.
PED Pro.
Pedestrian protection.
Okay.
Yeah. And certainly there is that problem from a packaging standpoint, and having taller hood profiles. But as I mentioned previously, with the pyrotechnics of detonating a hood, it actually allows us to get a lower hood profile. So you don't have to have that huge gap between the hood surface, first damageable surface, and the fixed surfaces of the engine components.
Because you can pop the hood.
The hood pops.
Rearwards, at the upward. Base of the windshield. Yes. You can pop it up to give more crush space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what technology helps us.
Yeah, and in that case, it does. And then there was another one here, too, if I can find that right quick. 007 Mitch W. says, Peter, if it were not for Autoline After Hours on Thursday evenings, how would Peter keep out of trouble?
That's a good point. I will not say any more about that now.
It's nice that it just presumes that he is keeping out of trouble on Thursday nights, though.
Here's a great question, Joel. Do any car buyers have bad taste?
Oh, hell yes.
I didn't say that. Thanks, Peter.
Oh, hell yes.
Have any tools come along that let designers achieve more with less?
Technologically, absolutely. We've got rapid prototype scanning machines and milling machines. It's all a technological wonder how we're developing vehicles these days through traditional clay modeling by hand versus digital surface development.
Well, you can simulate so much these days and do so many iterations that, you know, you couldn't have done in that time.
Absolutely. As we talked about the aerodynamic testing, computational fluid dynamics, it's taking math data that was scanned off of the clay surface in the studio, and the engineers are running tests that evening. Instant gratification.
Here's another great question for you. What's your non-car creative outlet?
Non-car creative outlet, art.
What kind of
painting,
art?
Sculpture?
Anything.
Although I don't do so much of it anymore.
You're pretty busy these days.
When I go on vacation, I always take a watercolor tablet with me.
And just paint what?
And just paint whatever the scenery is around.
Cool. That sounds great. Ben, let's bring in another phone call here.
Hi, this is Angela Libera, calling from North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Just a question about Lincoln Design. Just wondering where we could see it go in the future, how they're going to differentiate it from Ford products, if we're going to see the split-wing grille evolve, or if maybe we'll get a new different design in the front. Pretty much it.
Well, you're not doing Lincoln.
That might be a segue for bring Max Wolf on, on the show.
Let's just say all of the above for right now, because they're working on making Lincoln better.
There's a very concerted effort to differentiate Lincoln from Ford, so there won't be any parts panel sharing. Underbody components, absolutely, for efficiencies, but very distinctive interiors and exteriors between the two brands.
Mm-hmm. And I've been told that this is the first time in Lincoln's history that it's actually had its own chief engineer and its own chief designer. And I don't know if that's true or not, but certainly it's if they ever had it before, it would be a long time ago. And, you know, that kind of, you know, devotion of resources suggest that they're serious about it anyway.
Well, I think they saw what Cadillac had to go through to reinvent Cadillac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Wolfgang Reitzle told him that 10 years ago, and they fired him for it.
Yeah.
15 years ago.
Well, it's a different company now. So yeah. They saw what Cadillac had to go through, and so they're going all in.
But actually, Lincoln was a standalone company. It had its own building. But we are talking more than half a century
ago. That's true, yeah.
That's how they got those great designs back.
I forgot about that.
At least standalone. And Ben, we got another phone call here. Let's bring it in.
Hi, this is the Florida Trucker calling. And I was wondering, do you also design the Econoline vans? And is there anything new coming down the pike on those? Thank you.
Yeah, Econoline vans are also designed. Like everything, they need to be evolved and meet certain federal regulations, so the Econoline is pretty long in the tooth from that standpoint, so it'll have to go through a change sooner or later in its life cycle here.
Well, you just did, or the company just did, I think, before you got there, sort of a facelift to the front end and some interior changes, and that was about a year ago.
Right.
And so it might be about 10 years before that gets changed again, the way those things seem to go.
Is that a vehicle that can evolve in the future to meet the fuel economy requirements that are coming, you think? Or is that the last of the dinosaurs?
No, I think there's an absolute need for those types of vehicles, even on a global basis. You look at what Mercedes Sprinter has done, all the European products, even our own Ford Transits. So it's could be a global vehicle.
Hmm. For the Econoline, could be a global vehicle?
Anything's possible with one Ford, right?
George wrote in, Chevrolet released a spy shot of the tail lamp of the Malibu, and he's asking, have we seen the new Malibu yet? And if so, what do we think about it?
We've seen it.
It's changed from the one that we saw, though. I mean, we were shown a couple of times under embargo a version, and my understanding is that it's changed significantly, and the tail light and rear fender that was in the detail shot they sent out today definitely did look different.
So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I saw it a year ago, and it was kind of a busy design is the way. I thought they were trying to do too many things with it, and maybe that's what they've smoothed out, Mark.
Yeah.
There was a lot going on with that design.
And I felt like the detail shot in particular seemed to say that they were trying to draw on some family resemblance to the Camaro in particular. And I think that they want to do that because Camaro is a vehicle that in the markets where Chevrolet is not known, people do know what the Camaro is. And the idea that they could have a car that makes sense for them that looks a little bit like a Camaro could be appealing.
And that's exactly right, because it does have Camaro design cues in it, or at least the version that I saw of it does, or did.
Tell me more.
Oh, yeah. If you could only read my mind here.
We'll see it soon enough.
CM wants to know, with the exception of the Chrysler 200, none of the big three sell a four-seat convertible in the U.S. market. Why? Audi, BMW, Volkswagen, Nissan, Mitsubishi, etc., all have four-seat convertibles. Is that right? Mitsubishi?
Well, I mean, do they? I mean, the Eclipse used to, but I don't know if they still do the Eclipse convertible.
Right. Why no four-seat convertibles?
The Mustang.
Mustang? Oh, Camaro?
There you go.
But neither Mustang or Camaro is really a practical four-seater. I mean, the Toyota Solara and the Sebring and 200 are the only two convertibles that I know of in this market that say we're not going to try to be sporty, we're not going to try to be exciting, we're going to be the car that the retired couple and their two best friends can go out to dinner on a summer night for. And they own that market, and there are some people who want it. Yeah, yeah. Perhaps not Peter.
Peter's being put to sleep by this.
Well, no, I mean, four-seat convertibles, I don't know.
To me, if you're going to do a four-seat convertible, it should be gigantic. It should be big.
Well, it should be like
a big four-door convertible.
It should be a Rolls.
Yeah,
Rolls or Bentley, just some statuesque thing rolling down the road. But.
Joseph in Lodi says, or Lodi?
Lodi.
He says, I haven't heard you talk about the news that Ford asked dealers to please stop ordering black cars because the metallic paint comes from a source in Japan. Are you guys being much affected by that?
The whole industry is affected by it, quite frankly.
I think it's just one specific black, though, isn't it?
Piano black is what everything I've read.
It's called tuxedo black in Ford.
Right.
But it's not the black itself. It's the special pigment called Zerillic that goes into the black, that goes into a number of other paints, not only in the Ford portfolio, but all the OEMs, quite frankly.
It's funny.
So you can get a Ford any color but black? Henry is rolling over in his grave.
It'll be a solid black.
Yeah. It's funny. Tuxedo black was GM's black in the 60s.
Is that right?
Yeah. I remember the Corvette was tuxedo black. And GM got away from naming names of their colors, which I think was a lost art anyway. But I'm glad someone's using tuxedo black.
Let's see here. We've got a lot of questions. I don't think we're going to be able to get to them all. And I'm just trying to see if we've got another. Oh, yeah, looks like we got some more phone calls. Let's bring some in here. Ben, next phoner.
This is Jim from Sioux Falls. I have a question about how much effort designers put into the glass on a car. For example, the car I currently have, if it's snowing outside, it seems as though the snow will pile up on my back window, and I have to stop at stop signs and get out and grab the snow brush and brush it off fast. And I just can't believe that designers ever thought about things like that, because if they did, they would not design the roof line and the rear window so that snow could just pile up on there and it doesn't move no matter how fast I'm going down the road. So just curious about something like that.
Well,
thanks, bye.
Sometimes it's not worth going out in the snow, number one. Number two, invest in Rain-X and use it because it works. And number three, sometimes you aren't going to be able to get 5 inches of snow off the back window. That's why they say when you go out, clean off your windows. So, you know, but everyone gets in their cars and go down the road and says, ah, it'll blow off. So I don't know about that. If it's a question between snow that comes off and a really good-looking roof line, I'll take the roof line all day. I'll clean off the snow.
I think most customers will, too.
Yeah, I'm not going to look at an ugly-ass car just because the snow flies off easily. It's not a good
thing. But I will say one thing. I thought this is where the question was going to go. Tumble home in today's cars. You know, I open the car up, and it's been out in the snow, and boom, it drops right
out. That's why they call it tumble home.
Whatever happened to the drip rail? You remember that? Just that
bad for aerodynamics.
Is that an aerodynamic killer?
Because I have the same effect.
Yeah.
It depends how far
it's a quality killer.
But there are some vehicles that actually incorporate the drip rail
channels
into the channel of between the sheet metal and the chrome molding.
Yeah.
So it's there are different ways.
But is there anything to do with what I'm talking about of the snow? And sometimes if it's a powdery snow, you know, I'll brush off the car and I'll open the door, and just the air current from opening the door sucks a whole bunch of snow right onto the seat. And then it's like, dang.
Yeah. Bummer.
Peter has no sympathy for me today at all.
Yeah. John, there's a state called Florida in your future.
Ben, next one. Let's bring it in.
Hi, this is Mike from Troy, Michigan. I have a question. Today on John's program this afternoon, I saw where Buick is coming out with a rebadged Ampera, which is actually a Volt with a new fascia. I wonder if General Motors is going back to the bad old days where they lost all their imagination and they couldn't figure out how to come up with something that would capture the attention of the consumer, and I'd like your comments on that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Joel, is GM losing it totally? No, I'm not going to put that to you.
I will, you know, take a shot at that one since it's teed up, if I can.
Sure, go ahead.
The idea of Opel becoming Buick design for a lot of passenger cars is a really good idea, I think. And the Volt is the only place where it looks like there's overlap between, you know, Chevrolet and Opel. And I think, I really hope that it has been misunderstood what you know GM is talking about with that, because if they bring in some sort of a small car that uses the Volt technology for Buick, that's great. If it looks like a Volt and it's got a Buick, you know, grill on it, that's just idiotic, and, you know, really, you know, somebody should go home and rethink that decision tonight. I think it's a real mistake.
Well, don't forget, though, where this is coming from. It's coming from Lieutenant Dan, because he wants to up the volume of the Volt technology, and maybe he doesn't appreciate the struggles this industry has had with badge engineering in the past.
But is it the technology or is it the car itself?
Well,
that's the key differentiator.
That's the key, and we don't know. Yeah. I suspect they're going to hang a grill, be a grill on
the Volt. Of course they're going to hang a grill. Look, I mean, you guys got to look at the volume of these things. You know, to be able to tool up a unique body for a Buick based off the Volt, and you're going to sell, what, for the first 3 or 4 years, $10,000 a year? I mean, you're going to have to charge a fortune, or just eat it and lose a bunch of money on the car. So the simple solution.
What can you add to the Volt to make it, to justify the price premium a Buick needs to ask? I think they
unless
have to do a different vehicle. I really think they have to do a different vehicle.
Yeah, unless it's the Opel, which looks quite a bit.
The front end looks significantly different.
But it's only the front end. It's the lights and the grill.
From the cowl back, it's the same car.
Yeah.
And
the interior is essentially the same, the controls, all of that.
And it's easy to criticize GM, and we're doing it. But I keep coming back to the fact that this thing's going to be extremely low volume, and you just can't afford to tool up a unique body for it without losing a bunch of money or charging a bunch of money. And once you charge that, you're not going to sell a bunch of them.
Yeah.
So, and I think we got one more phoner here.
Yo, man, this is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio.
All right.
I'm just wondering, how's Scott Burgess doing? Hope he's doing well. Give us an update if you can.
I was talking to Scott today, and he's good.
He's back in the
saddle.
He's
happy to be back at the news, and I believe he had a review in today's Detroit News.
Yes.
In fact, but he's quite pleased to be back, and it appears that the forces of virtue won out on that one.
Yeah, that's right. No, it all in the end, it all worked out for the good. So, thanks for calling in about that, young blood. And look, this is probably a good time for us to wrap up this show. But Joel Piskowski, great having you on here. This has been terrific having you here.
Thanks, John. Great to be in the studio with you.
It's always fun to talk about design. And Mark Phelan, great having you here as well.
Thank you very much.
Having you here. And Mr. De Lorenzo, as always.
2 years and counting.
2 years. I'm blown away by that. I'm so glad that you brought that up. And remember, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us at twitter.com/OutOfLine. You must read AutoExtremist.com every week. You can find all of Mark's stuff at freep.com.
Absolutely.
F-R-E-E-P.com. And if you really want to see what Joel's work is all about, keep an eye on all the Ford showrooms because it'll be coming to one near you soon.
Thanks, Jeff.
So thanks, everybody, for having tuned in to today's show.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. And by Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more